We'll just start this up. All right. Tonight we have Mark Becker. And Mark Becker founded Iron Guides in 1999 with the aim of making simple, effective training methods available to accomplished and new triathletes. Mark has nearly 25 years of firsthand experience in working with some of the best coaches in the world. During that time are the foundations of the method, Iron Guides' uniquely and highly effective training approach. Mark has been a certified triathlon Canadian coach since 1992 and coaches Iron Guides' premium clients with running the best business behind the scenes. Mark has tons and tons of triathlon experience, and he's also a very accomplished athlete. And with that, I welcome Mark Becker to the call. How you doing, Mark?
Hey, pretty good. Thanks, Kerry, for that. And thanks for having me on the Triathlon Summit. Great that you're putting this together for folks.
Well, I'm very happy to have you on. I'm sure a lot of other people are too. So let's start off with the first question here, and that is basically, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and about Iron Guides?
Yeah, sure. Iron Guides was founded, as you said, in the late 90s, 1998, in Calgary, Canada, where I'm from originally. I live in Europe now, and I've been taking part in triathlon as an athlete and as a coach since the late 80s. So I started in 1987, and I got into it like most people, dabbled a little bit at the age group level, started with a sprint and worked up by the end of that first season to an Ironman. And little by little, I just kind of got hooked. And a few years later, I ended up making the Canadian elite team and ended up at the World Championships on the podium with some of the other elite team members after we won the 1992 World Championships. So that was sort of a very early highlight in my triathlon career. And from there, I was a sub-150 Olympic distance non-drafting athlete, sub-4 hour for the half Ironman, and did a 903 in Kona 1 year. So that was sort of the summaries of my participation in the sport. And I did the sport for about 15 years full-on, until I retired in 2003 and focused more on the coaching side of things. So I was an athlete and a coach for a while. And in 2006, I retired from working at other jobs and decided to give it a go at Iron Guides as a full-time coach. And since then, I've been focusing on building up the business and really servicing our premium clients while coaching coaches and certifying them in how I perceive triathlon training ought to be applied. And that's sort of the background on how Iron Guides evolved over the last 10 or 11 years. And we have, I think, about 13 coaches now in different locations around the world. And we run training squads from their locations. So they invite people to come and train with them, not just online. We have a huge group of almost 40 athletes in San Diego, for example. There's somebody just starting up in Edmonton in Canada. We've got people we're talking to in Scotland, actually, in Edinburgh. There's someone in Germany setting up. There's somebody in Noosa, Australia. We've got somebody in Bangkok. There's someone in Rio de Janeiro. And a bunch of people starting up all across the States right now. So everybody shares one thing, and that is they apply the method, which is what I call our approach to training. And they do this online and face-to-face with people. So that's roughly the short history version of Iron Guides.
Awesome, good deal. You guys are spreading out for sure.
Cool.
So you've done a lot of work with Brett Sutton. Can you tell us a little bit about that and tell us about the involvement you have with Team TTB, who he coaches, or TBB,
Yeah, Team TBB. Sure, yeah. No, I met Brett back in around 2002 or so, and I basically got a hold of him. I'd met him once before in the 90s at a race in Ontario. I got a hold of him because I was coaching somebody and I wanted just a little bit more information about what might be optimal for them. And I'd heard of him here and there and wasn't quite sure how to get a hold of him for my own training. So I never got coached by Brett. But after 2002, he and I started up a running dialogue that was basically email correspondence every day for, man, probably a good 5 years solid. And I just basically learned an entirely new perspective on what triathlon training could be. Back in Canada, where I'd learned to be a triathlete and where triathlon coaching was sort of first introduced to me, I'd come across, you know, the basic mode of triathlon coaching that we know in North America, and that is zone training, even power-based training. It's become sort of a generic form of coaching people. And the more I talked to Brett, the more I learned that what he did really had nothing at all in common with what we were learning in North America at the time. So starting in 2002, I started asking him a lot of questions, and he started giving me a lot of answers. And I started learning what I'd been doing wrong as an athlete, and why I was experiencing certain failures or disappointments in my training despite really putting out massive hours and taking the sport to a fairly high level. I won a couple of Canadian Half Ironman championships and came off the bike in 13th place at Kona one year and just had an abysmal run and ended up 44th. So despite putting in 35, 40-hour training weeks all summer long and having some really solid sub-3-hour marathon results in training on, you know, big volume weeks and so on, I was kind of confused. Why was I training so hard, and why was I going nowhere when it really came down to it? And why was I so tired all the time, and why did I sort of feel like a broken wreck at the end of the season? So about a year or two after these experiences, I met Brett, and, well, basically we started sharing information. In the end, about 4 or 5 years later, through a friend of mine in Singapore, I learned of a guy who was starting up a new bike shop in Singapore and spoke to him briefly and realized that he was looking for somebody to help him promote the bike store in a new way in Asia and also to promote the sport of triathlon and cycling in Asia. And everything he described really sounded like what Brett had already done in Brazil. So I put the two of them together, and Alex and Brett started up Team TBB and launched their squad through training in Asia and promoting the sport there and trying to replicate what Brett had done in Brazil. I don't know if people are familiar, but Brett really developed a lot of Brazil's top athletes from a background where there was very little exposure to top-end knowledge. So anyway, to make a long story short, the experience I had in North America as an athlete was very, very different and came from a completely different view on triathlon than what I learned from Brett as a coach. And what Brett really taught me was really the other side of the coin. In North America, we tend to be very, very focused on aerobic conditioning, for better or worse. He tends to be very, very focused on skills acquisition, and I like to call it programming the red meat computer. One analogy we use at Iron Guides a lot in our training of athletes is the phrase wax on, wax off from the Karate Kid. And a lot of what Brett has done with athletes is apply this wax on, wax off kind of perspective on training and to teach motor skills. And he's done that with young, driven athletes who want to be world champions, which are really the most open to this approach. And I watched from afar and listened over the years to how he trained people and how different it was. And gradually over time, I started recognizing the pattern and recognizing the language of the body and how his training principles were received by the body and how this correlated to the mistakes I'd made and the different approach in thinking about triathlon training that we have in North America through zone-based and power-based training. So my involvement at Team TBB evolved after Brett and Alex got together. They were looking for somebody to apply a similar coaching approach to age group athletes. And I got on board, and Iron Guides worked for a brief time with Team TBB to deliver age group coaching and training advice. And over time, I realized, working with them, that age group athletes and professional triathletes have extremely different needs. Not just different needs, but very, very different needs. And so what I learned was that what worked very well for elite athletes in one context didn't really work so well for age group athletes. And I wasn't really trying to apply so much what Brett was doing for the pros to age groupers. I really had my own ideas. And in the end, I decided, well, it was probably better that if I was going to apply my ideas, I did that on my foundation. So that's why Iron Guides is no longer with Team TBB. But they're doing well on in their thing, and we wish them well in their thing, and we're doing well with ours. So, and we've made a few changes to our approach, and it works. So people are benefiting from that.
Good deal. All right. So you've been talking a lot about the method there. So why don't you tell us what the method is and how it's, you know, different from most triathlon training out there that you were talking about a little bit there with zones and things.
Sure. Yeah. The method is not a formulaic approach to training. We can't say to an athlete, well, here's your heart rate, or here's your lactate threshold, or here's your critical power output. The method is more a set of principles and guidelines and perspectives on triathlon training that Iron Guides coaches use to train their athletes. Okay, so I've collected this into an approach that takes a long time to learn, because what we're actually working against is a set of conditioned ideas that we have acquired, especially in North America, a little in the UK as well, and maybe in Germany and Australia also, but in those places where the internet has really taken hold, along with that, in parallel, there's been this approach to triathlon training that has taken hold. And I've really come to see and witness that it's not necessarily the most effective way to train. So the method teaches, rather than thinking about training as a way to get aerobically fitter, we say training is a way to acquire skills and strength, power, and get aerobically fit anyway. We really de-emphasize the focus on getting aerobically fit, because our perspective is that a properly structured training plan for triathlon or any sport, really, you're going to get aerobically fit regardless, as long as you focus on sport-specific skills and you do these in the appropriate volume and durations that your races demand. Okay, so we take the view that skills, strength, and speed are very neglected in triathlon training. We look at building a mix of triathlon training sessions during the week that focus on developing skills, strength, speed, also tolerance, what some people call maybe anaerobic threshold training, which is a loose term these days, or lactate threshold training, which is also a loose term, and endurance. Okay, we just call the former tolerance. By balancing training across these five systems, skill, strength, speed, tolerance, threshold, and endurance, we enable athletes to train very consistently without getting overwhelmed by fatigue like I experienced in my training. Okay, so we apply this approach to training, this balance across five systems, through a principle of repetition. We really believe that athletes need to have a repeatable plan, something that they do over and over again. And within that plan, the sessions rely a lot on repetition, not just in swimming. We're all familiar with swim training based on interval training, but we also apply this to cycling to a lesser degree than to running as well, where we have an approach that's based on repetition of certain sessions and within those sessions sets. Okay, so the next emphasis that we include in what I call the method is that training is structured so that recovery is optimized. You're only as good in your training as you are recovered from the previous session. So we look at the training as, how can I train most effectively today based on what I did yesterday without compromising what I need to do tomorrow? And to get a better understanding of what that question really entails, we look at training as, for triathlon, as largely a catabolic process. That is, triathlon training strips the body down. If you look at a top pro, for example, you can see they are reduced to the bare necessities to get the job of triathlon done to the maximum ability possible. That sounds a little complicated, but it's not. What I'm basically saying is that triathlon training strips the body down, and we need to figure out how to build the body up as quickly as possible so that I'm not so tired the next day from this breaking down process. And so by breaking up our sessions into these five systems, a coach at Iron Guide is always looking at, well, what happened to the body yesterday? How did the body get broken down? What was the catabolic effect on the body? Were we breaking muscles down? Were we really working fast twitch muscles? Were we working slow twitch muscles? Were we really taxing the aerobic system? How were we taxing it? Were we taxing it in a tolerance way or an endurance way? If it's taxed, what can the guy do or the woman do today that can still train them hard without further taxing the aerobic system? Or if the muscles are really tired today from what we did yesterday, how can we still work the body hard without taxing those muscles more? So we look at it in terms of five systems and not just three sports. And we don't just say easy day followed by a hard day and rotate around that way. Because, in fact, if you structure your training appropriately, you can have a training plan that works you hard every day. And you're going to feel recovered the next day because this training is so focused on one particular aspect or system, and it is so thought out that the next day's session doesn't tax you in the same way the previous day's or previous session of the same day did. Okay, so by looking at this catabolic process, we can almost start looking at the body as an equilibrium between anabolic and catabolic hormones in your body. Because I spoke earlier about the language of the body. The language of the body is really transferred through hormones in the body. A catabolic process on the body, a stripping down of the body in response to the training stimulus, is communicated through the body, throughout the body, by hormones. We know about things like cortisol. We know about testosterone. We know how these hormones balance out in the system or respond to the stimulus on it. There was a study done in 1995, and I'm sorry, but I don't remember the writers of the study, the researchers. But basically, they showed that the only really reliable marker of overtraining or overreaching, as we refer to it as well, is the ratio of cortisol to testosterone in the human body. As we immerse ourselves in a more catabolic environment from training, the cortisol levels in our body increase and testosterone decreases somewhat. If you really, really train hard, you can reduce your testosterone levels so much that as a male, you start shaving less often, for example. Less testosterone means you break your body down, your muscles break down, you're not building muscle mass as quickly or as readily. You might put on fat a little more easily, and so on. There's all kinds of ways of measuring this, of feeling it in the human body. So without going to extremes that you're training that hard, as I did and as many athletes in the sport have, where you are actually interfering with normal hormone levels, without going to that extent, you can still look at your training from that angle and say, okay, hard training in this way reduces testosterone, increases cortisol. Well, that's also a stress response in the human body. You can take a guy and expose him to highly emotionally stressful or mentally stressful events and get the same effect. So we start looking at the human body now also as how does the athlete's stress levels from an emotional and mental standpoint or sleep deprivation or diet, how does that combine with their training? All those things, those five ways of stressing the human body all have influences on those same hormonal ratios in the body. So that's a really key component of not necessarily building training plans, but thinking about building them, where we differ, where we don't say zone 1, zone 2, zone 3. The only stress is really doing a lot of zone 1 or really, really working hard in zone 4, and I just have to worry about not getting my heart rate up or down. Well, we don't say that at all. In fact, we say a lot of zone 1 work can be deadly on your health and performance as an athlete because you're going to be exposing yourself to very, very high volumes of consistent training without stimulating other systems in your body that might actually improve recovery from that one-note Charlie kind of approach. Okay, so from that balance across these five systems and thinking of it as anabolic or catabolic stimulus on the body is how we build our approach to training. So we ignore power output, except as maybe a reference by an athlete. You might say, oh, I hit this in that session. So we know through repetition, he's got a benchmark every week. That's another principle. And we know through his feedback to us based on intuitive understanding, because he's repeating his training a lot, he's going to get more and more familiar with the same sessions every week. He's going to understand how stress, how sleep deprivation, how change in diet, how extra rest perhaps influences his training, and he's going to develop a better feel for how the training affects him and how his life and the rest of his life affects the training. So these are all principles of the method, so I can't say there's a formula to it. All those things go into it.
All right, good stuff. All right, so what does the method say about periodization, and why do you generally not prescribe days off to your athletes?
Okay, good question. It's very common in triathlon these days to think about periodization using the standard, you know, base building, pre-season, competitive season recovery approach. We don't take that view on things. We think about athletes in the age group spectrum of having really one main enemy, especially once you're into your 30s, and especially after 40, you lose motor skills very, very quickly. You lose strength quite quickly. So we like to keep all these five systems firing constantly throughout the year with appropriate rest. I mean, we're not going to tell somebody to go out for a hard workout the day after Ironman or the week after and so on. What we really focus on is ensuring that all five systems are constantly stimulated. And rather than having a long two-month base building of lots of easy training and so on, we would say, okay, you're going to reduce the volume in the winter, you're going to focus on skills acquisition, and we're going to make sure that you're not training at such a high volume that you're actually building a lot of fatigue. We're just going to work on getting your motor skills up, rebuilding strength from the season, and actually working on speed and not long, slow distance. We've all heard about capillarization and all these things. We don't pay attention to that component because there are other factors that come into training that make a much bigger impact, and that consistency is one of them. I said that age group athletes, especially after the age of 40, lose motor skills quite quickly. Well, especially in the pool. Anything you haven't done a lot in your life, by the time you're 40 and you try to learn it, these new skills are difficult to acquire, so you have to practice them frequently. So we'd rather have people frequently swimming than doing a lot of work on the bike or a lot of work on long, slow runs in the winter. Like I said earlier, we get the aerobic conditioning anyway. So we focus on building up these skills and building a really strong, reasonably skilled athlete. The other reason we do that is that what we've found is that the more volume people do, the more tired they tend to be. And the more tired they are, the less hard they can actually train in training. The less hard they can train, the less they develop power and strength, and the less they can focus on reasonable form or technique in all three sports. So, yeah, there's some aerobic development benefits, but we have a mechanism, a body that, and a mind that can't really apply the benefits of this big engine that they're building. So we say, well, let's not worry so much about the engine. We're going to get the engine anyway. Let's train in a structured way that really focuses on these other systems. Okay, so our periodization is less of a concept that we worry about compared to zone training, for example.
Right, right. Okay, so why don't you tell me a little bit about what you mean when you talk about training structure and how it can help recovery?
Okay, sure. I guess in a nutshell, the method probably answers one question, and it says, how do I optimally combine the acquisition of sport-specific skills with maximal aerobic conditioning? So the greatest fatigue your body can experience, from our view, is when you're training for aerobic gains. If you're thinking exclusively about getting aerobically fitter, we say endurance training and high-end sustained aerobic training is what is the main enemy, so to speak, of the body. That's what's going to tax you most. That's what's going to create the greatest catabolic response and wipe you out. So you hear about people always racing or training like they're racing, and they get wiped out or plateau very early in the season, or it's not even the season yet. They're also called the Kings of January in cycling. They're racing really hard or training really hard when they've recovered in December and January they're flying, and come April when the first races of the season hit, they're nowhere because they've blown themselves up. So this kind of high-end intense training and the long, the deep fatigue you get from long aerobic training, like 7-hour bike rides, 3-hour runs, and so on, we tend not to focus on that kind of training. Rather, we have a few ways of making sure athletes don't go into this overload, highly catabolic state from high-end or long aerobic training. One I've already mentioned, that is, we train one system while the others rest. Okay, so that is part of an optimally built training plan. It should not stress systems that are stressed from training earlier that day or from the day before. We also build in insurance into each training session that does require the athlete to work hard and intense for longer periods. So, for example, we have a standard run set that's a negative split run set, and it depends on the ability of the athlete, but we build them up over time to roughly 20 minutes moderate, 20 minutes reasonably uncomfortable, but not all out, and then 20 minutes of roughly 10K pace. Mm-hmm. If you think about that session, they've properly warmed up for over 40 minutes because they've done a little bit of work before the session starts.
Right.
By the time they get to their 10K effort. Now, we know a 10K race pace is basically an effort somebody can do for 10K. That's the definition, right? So if
right.
you're doing 20 minutes of that after you've already been working for 40 minutes, you're starting it when you're quite tired already. There's no way you can hold it for 40 minutes. Your body is tired from running for 40 minutes already. You do 20 minutes of 10K, you don't really have much left over at the end of that session. But you also haven't raced a 10K. Your body has not perceived 10 kilometers of 10K race effort. So you haven't actually taxed your body like a 10K race at all. You've built in insurance by fatiguing the body before you actually begin that level of effort. So we do that kind of stuff throughout a weekly session. Somebody might have a 4-hour ride or a 6-hour ride, depending on where they are in the year and what they're training for, what level they're at. We'll say, okay, the final hour of your 6-hour ride, go as hard as you want. And we know, basically, there's no way the person can hurt themselves or go over the top aerobically. A lot of people out there doing zone training or other sort of power-based sessions might say, well, they're so tired from 5 hours of riding already, that's going to put them over the top, and it's going to totally destroy their week. Well, the opposite is true. There's no way they can go hard enough after riding 5 hours to really risk destroying themselves. Remember, I said aerobic effort is where you got to really watch about destroying the body. The muscles recover a lot faster than the aerobic system. People who get overtrained or who go really flat in training, overreach, that tends to take place because of too much high-end aerobic work or too much volume work, too much endurance, and we go flat. Okay, so that's a couple of examples of how the right mix can be built into a plan. A little insurance, work one system while the other is resting. Okay, and as long as we remember that muscles are going to be giving out from one kind of effort before the aerobic system will, we can use that knowledge that the muscles are tired and have somebody work really hard with tired muscles, knowing that they're not going to stress their aerobic system as much as they could if they were fresh. We use that understanding throughout our training approach. Okay?
Yep. Great. All right, let's talk a little bit about training volume then, because I'm assuming then that you guys don't do a ton of volume. So how is it that you decide the best volume and training frequency for an athlete?
Good question. We really treat everybody as different, okay? We don't just look at their age and say, here's your zones. Okay, if I were to take an athlete as a zone-based coach and say, okay, what's your age, subtract it from 220 or 225, or have them run a max heart rate test, subtract the heart rate we derive there, so subtract their basal resting rate and come up with the range of heart rate beats they can work with. If you do that, well, logic dictates that between, say, 20 and 80, there's 60 years of age there, you've got roughly 60 different heart rate zones or structures of zone to work with. That's not the way the human body works. We're not 60 different kinds of people just because we're 60 different ages. You follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
We go a little bit beyond that. We say, well, first of all, we got to know your time available. We got to know your life commitments. What stress and responsibilities do you have in your life? Where's your time going? Your age matters a lot, but from a motor skills perspective, what's your gender? A muscular male, for example, can't train nearly as hard in terms of intensity as somebody that's not quite as muscular, as a lean, very wiry athlete, because he's got so much muscle mass. When he's training hard, he's doing a lot more damage to his body. So an athlete like that, we have to take them and train them a lot more moderately. He might be better off doing a bit more volume rather than speed work. He's going to be really destroyed by a lot of tolerance or threshold work. We look at their past experience. We look at their skills. Where are you at right now in each sport? And we look at their goals and say, well, what's attainable given all this? And then we decide on volume and training frequency. But by and large, volume is less than with most other training protocols. Frequency is probably higher. So they train more often, but less volume. And day-to-day, people are more recovered. We don't assign off days, however. Yet we find people are feeling more rested, and they recover faster from races without actually having built-in recovery in their training. And the reason for that is that, when I referred earlier to hormonal levels in the body, we like to think of keeping a nice, even keel, always having sort of a stable equilibrium in the body. So when you're in training mode, we want to keep you in training mode. We don't want you resting every week for a day. Because what happens, the muscles bind up, you lose mobility, your hormone balances change, you get a little recovery because the muscles are actually recovering, of course, but if the training plan is structured, they can be recovering in a completely different way while you're working another system. And what we found is that people can train 6 weeks, 4 weeks, 8 weeks. We have a 75-year-old guy in California training 8 weeks straight without a day off, setting PRs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's 75 years old. A lot of this feedback tells us what we've long suspected, is that motor skills really, really matter. Even if you're not improving to the point of being perfect, that doesn't matter. Your body's getting used to a certain motion, and it becomes easier and easier to do it. That analogy, wax on, wax off. The Karate Kid got out there, and in the tournament, all that sanding of the deck and the polishing of the car that he'd done in that movie all came out in these motions that were just second nature. A piano player, same thing. Same principles are at work. In triathlon, we neglect that. We think it's all about lungs and heart. Those are important. But if you have a really efficient machine that knows by second nature how to move, that engine is going to be way more effective. Or you can do a lot more with a smaller engine.
Right. Okay. So, in terms of, you know, you don't really rely on power meters and heart rate monitors or lactic testing. Why is that exactly?
Yeah, great question. It sounds a bit old school because we tend to, you know, we poke fun at these things. But let me say clearly that all these tools are great tools if they're used appropriately. And they can be very effective. But by and large, I start sort of from the identity of your typical triathlete. Most triathletes already have a lot of commitments elsewhere. Your age group triathlete with a family and a job doesn't have much time left over. So for one, we would prefer that our athletes are either spending time with family or doing other things they like doing instead of crunching data, or their training. So that's one reason we don't introduce data-based training tools. We use other tools, but not ones that generate data like this. Another reason is that triathletes tend to be a little bit type A as a rule in their personality. Okay, so if we're always feeding a certain personality type something that it's already good at, it's not going to work its weaknesses. So there's people who are very, very good at focusing on quantitative analysis and detail in our sport. There's many, many of them. But they also can be people who aren't very focused when it comes to pain and can't manage pain tolerance because they're so fixated on the data. And so what happens is that often data will come across, and rather than confirming and increasing their motivation, they'll see, I'm not hitting my numbers, and boom, the world falls apart, and the rug is pulled out from under their feet. They're actually getting negative feedback from these tools. And that's not everybody, but it does happen to some people. So that's another reason not to use it. And thirdly, most importantly, is basically they don't tell us anything we need to know. That's the main reason. If your training plan is structured appropriately for somebody at that fitness level and gender and all the other factors I mentioned, the training plan itself will take care of generating the fitness in each of the systems that get you the results. We have people going an hour, hour and a half faster after just 3 or 4 months coaching on an Ironman that they'd done the year before, simply because we are asking them to focus their mind on training aspects of their body they haven't trained before. They're not just thinking about, oh, I got to make this zone and hold it there, plod, 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 or hammer, hammer, hammer. It really is about thinking what I'm doing. And these, not using power meters, heart rate monitors, or lactate testing, which is done very much anyway, but not using those things works best if you have a repeating training plan. So by repeating training plan, I mean we set up our plans for 7 days. So people work the same Monday session every Monday, maybe 4 to 6 weeks, sometimes 8 weeks, sometimes longer depending on how much interruptions they've had, sometimes less. But by and large, they get a repeated plan that they build into, and then they repeat that those weeks. And what happens is that they're tuning out a lot of noise out there. There's less distractions. Rather than focusing on heart rate or power, what they end up doing is focusing on form more. Or they'll see how to, as I mentioned earlier, change of diet or lack of sleep or more stress at work. How did that affect my training? So, yeah, okay, it affects my training like this. I had a great session anyway, even though I felt like hell. But, okay, so it was what I ate. Oh, maybe it was my sleep. So people learn that they can work through these feelings of discomfort and still achieve PRs in training or out on the race without needing to resort to an external reference point like power or heart rate. It becomes much clearer what's actually going on in the body because they're listening to the body. We've shifted their focus. So it's a very, very good question, and it's a very important part of how we coach people. We really want people to get back to the sincerity of what the sport was about, and sort of this spirit of exploration, really internal exploration almost, and have a feel for the thrill and the spirit of triathlon, and not be slave to the numbers.
All right. Despite not using a lot of quantitative tools, you do make use of a large variety of equipment in your coaching, such as paddles for swimming, buoys for swimming,
yep,
as well, spin bikes for cycling, treadmills for running, and even a metronome. So can you explain how you use these?
Yeah,
and,
sure.
You know, why, too?
yeah, no, of course. That's a good question because people kind of wonder, well, if you're all about the spirit of triathlon and just going out and doing it, why am I not out in the woods running, and why am I on a treadmill instead, and why am I not on my bike outside and I'm on a spin bike instead? Well, basically, it comes down to a choice for one. Do you want to make the maximum use of your time and really strive for those performances? Then we use these tools because they enable us to achieve certain things we can't do without them. So paddles and pull buoy, for example. If you're applying paddles to a swimmer, one thing you do is you tire his muscles out. Okay? And remember what I said earlier about building insurance into your training sessions. If you tire someone's muscles out, once the muscles are tired, you can quite safely have them train an all-out effort without risking that they're going to destroy their aerobic system from that effort. And the reason for that is they can't push to maximal because their muscles are too tired to push them there. So in swimming, we'll tire people out using paddles, and we'll throw a pull buoy on because in triathlon, what you know as well as a coach, is that most people's weakness is their swim. they're not very skilled at the swim because it's a very technique-laden sport to learn, and they're starting late in life. The new motor patterns are very difficult to acquire. We put a pull buoy on them to get their body higher in the water without struggle. Right away, they can focus on aspects of their swimming that are much more important in a race than having the perfect kick. They're going to wear a wetsuit anyway, 9 times out of 10. The pull buoy lets their mind not worry about struggling in the water and kind of plowing through it. They're going to be in a horizontal position. Automatically, their stroke's going to be improved from that, and they don't have to worry about 100 things their body's screaming at them when they're trying to breathe and their legs are sinking to the bottom of the pool. The right shape of paddles can make a big difference. The right choice in paddles for swimmers can teach them a better stroke simply from how it forces the arm through the water. A really flat, wide paddle will create automatically a glide effect, so the person doesn't have to think about it. It's such a technically difficult sport to master, and we can only really think about one or two things at once. And on top of that, when you are learning a new skill, you need to focus on those one or two things for weeks, if not months at a time, before it really gets picked up by the body and you can apply the next little bit of technique mastering to that swimmer. So we use these tools in the pool to help people learn a proper technique a little quicker. We use spin bikes so that people can harness strength a little bit more and really work against super high resistance at such levels that you just can't get on a road bike. Even on the steepest hill, what happens is that you really compromise technique and position if you're climbing a 20% grade. And there is still always a little forward momentum, so there's a little dead spot in the pedal stroke that you can get rid of on a spin bike, and you can really focus. We use a treadmill because treadmills let you run at a faster speed at a given aerobic load than you could do on land. A very slight 1 or 2% decline downhill on land or a strong tailwind has the same effect. And the good thing about that is, while we're training motor skills that are at a high speed, we're training those while we have some assistance in dealing with the aerobic load. The treadmill does a little bit of the work for us. It carries our foot backwards. So it's a great way to do the wax on, wax off thing for running. So there's a rough idea of some of the tools we use and why.
All right. Let's talk about running a little bit. You emphasize running with a stride rate of 96. And why 96, and how did you come up with this exact number? Is there any science to it or whatever?
Yeah, sure. Good question. We break it up into 96 strides per minute as a goal, as a target. It's about training for something. We're not saying running at 96 is optimal. Different body types will ease into different stride rates. But 96 is just a simple number to use when you are running because it divides easily into so many things, or so many numbers divide easily into it. So you can easily track over 15 seconds, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, 12 seconds, 8 seconds, or 6 seconds, how many strides you're running, and understand how much that is per minute. If 6 divides into 96 16 times, so I can multiply by 16 what I just ran by 10 into a minute, so I can get my 9.6 stride rate immediately dialed down. But the point here to understand, too, is that if 96 is a goal, it's not what you need to race at. By repeating the training over and over and always remembering, okay, I'm striving for a fast stride rate, roughly around 96, I'm teaching my motor neurons to fire at that rate over and over and over again till it becomes second nature, or at least till it becomes second nature to think about it. Because in a race, especially in the longer races, our legs are really tired, and they cannot do the explosive contractions that you can running a fresh run race. So we want to break the workload down, and it's important to understand cycling from this perspective as well. The workload a triathlete runner has to do comes on dead legs that cannot take as long a stride. So the work, if you think of the work as the 10K distance that you're moving your body through, you want to break that work up into more smaller, manageable pieces rather than trying to do it in less, bigger pieces. It's like taking a big boulder that's sitting in the yard and trying to get it from one side of the yard to the other. You break it down with a pickaxe into a whole bunch of little pieces, and you use the wheelbarrow many times to take that boulder across the yard in pieces over and over again until the work's done, rather than struggling against this huge boulder that you can't shift. And running at a fast stride rate is particularly important for triathletes because of the tired legs that they're running on.
All right, good stuff. In terms of what you use with the method, and it's an approach that's been used with a lot of Ironman triathletes who, at the elite level and have gotten a lot of great results. So can this work for the average triathlete too, and how can, they benefit, if at all?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've got a recent email here in front of me from a guy who was top three pro in Hawaii a few years ago. And I think this gives a little bit of an illustration into how elites are using these ideas and how it applies also to beginner or intermediate athletes. And we're definitely about the intermediate or beginner athlete and not the pro. We don't coach very many pros, actually. It's all about making optimal use of very limited training time, not piling on 30 to 40 hours a week. So here's what he said. I'm in the middle of a big turnaround where I'm repairing and rebuilding my body after 6 years with too little rest, too much of the same training, and as a consequence, several injuries that I am in the process of healing. I can only agree with you on the assumption that most Ironman athletes are doing too much of the same and training too long. Iron Guide's 20-week Ironman training plan has been a good inspiration for the path I want to follow from here, and your ideas on recovery, hormonal changes, and motor skills especially. So my team and I will adopt your ideas in my training. And the point here is, here's somebody at the cutting edge of triathlon knowledge and applying it, getting more and more tired, getting injured from doing too much of the same and too much volume. And if, as a beginning athlete, we can avoid making those mistakes, we're already at least 6 years ahead of the curve. If we want to get rid of this notion that I have to do a lot of volume training to do an Ironman effectively, we need to look for an alternative. And I really think that that's what we provide. We're not sending people out just building an aerobic engine. We're sending them out building a strong mechanical infrastructure so that a little smaller engine is way more effective. We're not out there building V12s. We're building really effective V4s.
Right. Good stuff. So can you use the method with short course training and triathlons as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We train a lot of short course athletes. We sell packaged or pre-built training plans on the Iron Guides website that are tailored to sprint or Olympic distance. And, we get some really nice feedback from people, too. We had a guy last year in Cyprus buy one of our Olympic training plans, and he ended up going 8 minutes faster. He went from 207 to 159 at the same race, and he wrote us this nice email, and it was great to hear because he said, I credit it all to that structure of training because I didn't make any other changes. Same equipment, same race, same conditions, same diet, same workload, same stress levels. Everything else was the same. But he took 8 minutes off and went from 207 to 159, and he ended up winning the race when he was usually, just back of the podium in his results. So these principles apply. But the point that's important to understand is that we're not setting out a formula. You have to do exactly this workout and that workout and this workout. What we're providing is a way of looking at triathlon and triathlon performance and applying sort of a categorization of workload to the athlete and saying, well, you're going to be doing this, so you need to do this, this, and this, based on sleep, stress, diet, family, other commitments you have, and the goals you want to achieve in your race. And whether that's a sprint or an Ironman, it doesn't really matter. And whether you're a beginning athlete or an elite-level pro, it also doesn't matter. We had a guy who did 8:41 in his races at Ironman distance a few years ago, then started training more and more and more, and got slower and slower and slower. And again, he came across one of our plans did it for 12 weeks and went 8:28 after 3 years of going slower. I think that was Chris Dimitriev at Ironman WA last December.
Wow.
So it's this way of giving the body opportunity to rest by not stressing it all at once and not stressing it for months and months and months in volumes that are just not humanly sustainable. Kind of give it a break. But we're consistent. I like to tell people that it's like a drip, drip, drip of Chinese water torture, or like a chip, chip, chip of a stonemason chipping away at a statue, rather than big sledgehammer blows of training. We really are against applying things like Epic Camp or massive overvolume training for Ironman. You don't need it. You recover a lot faster from the races if you don't do that, and you get better results in the long term.
Right on, right on. All right, so if you had one piece of advice to give to athletes out there, triathletes out there, that would affect their performance, what would it be?
Ride through the rough spots. Everybody gets tired. Having a routine, a steady routine, a weekly routine that's predictable, and tune out the noise so that you can see where the rough spots, what's causing you to feel rough that day. If you have a constantly changing training plan, you're never sure if it's the training plan itself, if it's this new session or that new distance or that new training route that is causing this change in your fatigue level. Get used to having a routine. Make sure it's structured well and follow it. And then start becoming more aware of what's causing the fatigue. You'll probably start building better nutrition habits, better sleep habits, maybe take a load off at work a little bit. So ride through the rough spots and have a routine so that you can better gauge where these rough spots are.
All right, good stuff. You hear a lot of time people talking about they need to eat more carbs and they like do carbo loading before a race.
Mm-hmm.
And so what are your thoughts on diet during training and racing and recovery?
Yeah, sure, good question. We have a coach named Vinny Santana. He's our Bangkok-based coach. He used to be on Team TBV for a while. And he's from Brazil originally, and Vinny's got the distinction of being the fastest diabetic Ironman so far in history. He went 8:50 at Brazil 1 year when he was 22 years old. And what we've all learned from Vinny, which is really interesting, isn't really out there in the textbooks and manuals. Vinny had to learn himself how his diabetes could be managed while racing an Ironman. Like, how do you inject insulin during an Ironman race without giving up time to the competition? He had to figure these things out. How much insulin? How about in a taper? And so on. And some of the information he collected is on our blogs at Iron Guides, and it applies to all athletes, not just diabetics. What diabetics have the benefit of that we who don't have diabetes don't is awareness. They see how training and diet and stress and lack of sleep and travel, how all these things immediately affect blood sugar levels. So one great example, Vinny came to the end of his work phase before Ironman Brazil 1 year. He had about a 8 to 10 day taper or so. And from the end of heavy training, over the course of the next week and a half, the amount of insulin he had to inject into his body to deal with the carbs and food he was eating was 3 times higher. So triple the amount by the end of the taper he had to inject into his body than at the start of the taper. Now that happens to a typical athlete as well, except instead of a needle, we have something called the pancreas that is injecting insulin into the body of it constantly. And what the way to interpret this information is that as your training volume comes down, your body is injecting more and more insulin into the system because you're so used to training. The glycogen window we have after training, that is when our body is receptive to soaking up carbs. We don't need insulin for that. Our body,
right,
through exercise, opens that window that insulin normally does. That's why the pancreas produces the insulin, to open the cells up to soak up the nutrients that are in the bloodstream, including sugar. So we hear cases of people who, for example, put on a lot of weight during the taper. I heard an anecdotal piece of evidence once. Somebody put on 14 pounds during their taper. That's a lot. And we have athletes that have done that before. They've come to us, put on 10 pounds in a couple of weeks and so on. They go through these cravings. That's this massive insulin flux happening in their body. So our views on diet are to take into account your training and understand that as soon as you reduce training, you're going to get these cravings. And you can reduce those cravings by avoiding increasing insulin through the intake of carbs. So we're saying, man, steer clear of heavy carbo loading during your taper. Eat more protein. Avoid the starches, because you're not training as much for one, you don't need it. For another, there's already a pretty heavy insulin effect going on. There was a study done a few years ago that said, in Sweden, that showed that men especially can develop diabetes through stress alone. Okay, so all things being equal, exercise, sleep, and so on, stress levels alone can induce diabetes. So look at your stress levels during your taper. Often we're getting pretty anxious. We're traveling, we're wrapping up last-minute stuff at work, we've got commitments to our family because we know we're going to be super focused and withdrawn a bit for the race. So all these stresses are coming at us. Now, a diabetic on race morning can see their blood sugar levels going wild. We don't pay attention to that, and that's just from stress. So look at your stress levels. Watch your diet. Look at your sleep levels. If you don't sleep much, boom, residual insulin level in the body goes up. We metabolize insulin during sleep. So look at sleep levels. All these things I've mentioned, we tend to sleep less if we're under stress. We're eating poorly anyway. This is like a spiraling effect. So we say watch out on the carbs during your taper. The advice is correct from one perspective, carbo-loading works, but you don't really need to carbo-load specifically anymore if you've already reduced your training. Your body's soaked up and rebuilt its glycogen stores. Don't avoid carbs, just do it in moderation.
Gotcha. So in terms of, you mentioned balancing training loads with athletes' stress levels. So how do you do that exactly?
Oh, good question. Again, it relates back to, I mentioned very early in the call, how we induce a catabolic effect, and that cortisol and insulin are related. These have a catabolic effect on the body. Stress has a very catabolic effect on the body as well. So if you take it back to this perspective of, well, how do I balance a catabolic effect on the body? Well, I balance it with an anabolic effect. What's an anabolic effect? Well, an anabolic effect is something that builds your body up. Weight training, really high resistance, short efforts on the bike with a lot of rest. Short, I mean less than a minute, not long enough to really jack the heart rate up for a long time. High resistance, so it's strength and muscular recruitment effort. That's an anabolic effect on the body. It mitigates stress. So if you have somebody under a lot of work stress, sleep deprivation, dietary stress, emotional stress, they can still train. They don't need to go out for an easy jog. That might be the worst thing for them. They might need to go to the weight room if they're doing weights already. Or they might need to do very short 30-second to 1-minute power intervals with equal rest on the bike against super high resistance, so high you can't turn your cranks over faster than 40 cadence. We offer something like that to athletes every Monday or Tuesday because most of them have done a lot of endurance work during the weekend. Endurance is very catabolic. It strips the body down. Look at a marathoner, ultra cyclist, Ironman, very stripped down bodies. So Monday, Tuesday, we give them something more over in the anabolic spectrum of things. It's still catabolic in a sense, but it does mitigate another catabolic workout instead. It mitigates the catabolic effect of throwing another aerobically intense session at them.
All right. Yeah, let's actually talk a little bit about weight training. How do you use it in the method?
Yeah, good question. For the most part, we believe you should optimize your training time by being sport-specific. So we use paddles in the pool. There's a bit of strength stimulus there. We use a spin bike, as I said. And offer people this 1 minute or 30 second really, really hard big gear work to build strength specifically. But for people getting on over the age of 40, and especially in the retired athletes, people who are training over the age of 60, over the age of 50, that's where weight training really starts to matter. And it's for the same reasons. There's less testosterone in males as they age, so their ability to rebuild muscle mass and recover from very catabolic Ironman and triathlon training is reduced, so we hit them with an anabolic spectrum workout. And they go to the weight room basically for that stimulus to recover. It's not just to get stronger and build muscle mass. It's a way of, because remember, building muscle mass comes from increasing testosterone in the system, and the body responds to heavy weight training by increasing testosterone. But if you're already recovering in other ways, you need to recover in other ways from catabolic effects like a long bike ride, going to the weight room will help you recover from the bike ride faster, irregardless if it's also building muscle mass. You'll recover from your long ride faster by doing some weights. So the older the athletes get, the more that needs to be built into the program. But then you also have to look at it in context of, well, what is that person's goals? How much muscle mass do they have? How much time do they have? How close are the facilities? Well, you know, they're only training 10 hours a week. Do they really want to spend 3 hours in the weight room of that time? No, not really. We can get some strength effect out of the spin bike, big paddles, if they're a proficient swimmer, reasonable size paddles if they're not. Okay?
Yeah. Yeah, good stuff. All right. And, you know, you hear a lot about athletes who are worried about their weight and, you know, they don't think they can ever get into shape. So can the method help these people lose weight faster and more consistently than regular training methods?
Yeah, absolutely. For the same reasons I mentioned earlier, again, it goes back into understanding training effects on the human bodies from the perspective of how is this hormonal equilibrium affected. A lot of long, slow distance, inappropriately timed or inappropriate durations of high-end intensity work, not enough strength work, not enough speed work, very, very short, what we might even call VO2 max workouts. We don't think of it in terms of VO2 max training. We think of it as explosive, full power, full muscle recruitment efforts. These things can reduce the catabolic tendency of triathlon training. And if we look again at cortisol or insulin, these will cause you, if their levels are too high for too long, they will cause you to put on fat and you won't rebuild muscle or not as easily. If people are in a constantly stressed, highly sleep deprived, poor diet environment, and they're training a lot of endurance work, a lot of long, slow distance, and they're throwing themselves at their workouts in race mode and racing through the rest of their workouts or all of them, they've done a lot of things right there to shift the hormonal equilibrium to this catabolic, high cortisol, high insulin level state. That puts on fat. So if you move away from this catabolic spectrum and start thinking more about the structure of your training, how can we emphasize these systems that aren't being worked? How can we create a more anabolic response on some of these days to mitigate the endurance training, to mitigate the high-end aerobic training? What we see then is a shift towards a more steady state, a less catabolic state in the body. And that, in turn, means you're putting on more muscle and you're not in this tendency towards putting on body fat. So, yeah, people lose weight faster.
All right. Good stuff. That's all the questions I got for you. Do you have anything you'd like to add on to that?
I invite people to visit ironguides.net and take a look around at some of the articles we have there and just snoop around the site and see what they think and feel free to drop us a line. Really appreciate the opportunity here to speak to everybody on the Triathlon Summit.
Yeah, and thanks for coming on. And again, what's your website?
It's ironguides.net.
Awesome. I will email that out to everyone as well. So, Mark, thanks a lot for coming on.
You bet. Thank you, Kerry.
Thank you. Good deal.
Bye.